It's January 28th at 3 p.m. Nice to have the sound turned up. Thank you. We were planning to start out with a presentation by Senate Counsel, and it was really for the purpose of new members who aren't here with us. The rest of us probably have seen this a number of times. So at Ms. James' suggestion, we'll suggest they just meet with those members separately, unless they suddenly walk in the door, but I don't see that happening. Thank you so much for being up there and for agreeing to do that with them on an individual basis. So then I'd like to invite Mr. Zelli from the Met Council to join us. Good afternoon. And you have the most important people in the room, so.
I'm very happy to be with the most important
people in the room.
Good afternoon, Chair and Senators, committee members. My name is Charlie Zelli. I am the Chair of the Metropolitan Council, and I'm here with Hannah Pallmeyer, who knows how to run the PowerPoint, as well as the audio, in case that fails. And then I'm joined by a number of Metro Transit, Metro Council staff, who are experts if there's any questions that I can't answer. But I'm here to present Governor Walz's budget recommendations for capital investments in Met Council activity. And I know that you've all seen many PowerPoints, and just like the report that you just described, you've probably seen some of this a number of times. So I am going to go through a lot of the busway transit kind of 101 instructional and INI slides pretty quickly, because I know that many of you are familiar with it. But there is a full slide deck here, and I know it has some really good information. The recommendation, which is really the money page, and then I'll go through the presentation and then answer questions. It's $15 million for the arterial bus rapid transit capital improvement program, $4.6 million for our inflow and infiltration, kind of part of our wastewater system grant program, and then $2.3 million for regional parks and trails bonding program. So now I'll just jump through this busway capital improvement program. There really are three different kinds of busways. There's the mixed traffic ABRT, which is what I'm going to be talking about today. There's highway BRT, like the orange line, the red line, and soon to be the gold line. And then there's the exclusive BRT guideway system. Again, that is also like our gold line coming up. Let's see if that... we have a map that would be helpful to just refer to him for a minute, and that is really talking about the H line. Of all those ABRTs, arterial bus rapid transit systems, we have the B line under construction, we have the A, C, and D under operation, we have a number of them in planning stages, including the H line. This follows the F line and the G line. So is there just multiple lines? They've been very successful. We like to say that the population of the metro area have voted with their feet. They have really done well. They're back to 1919 levels, and having that more express on current high frequency routes with enhanced stations, enhanced entrance and exit, enhanced buses. It's been a great customer experience, and I think what it does not only provides great transit options, but it also connects large transit ways together to kind of create this one big system. Again, I'll go through these slides quickly. I described the ridership success, but just getting into this particular proposal. It is $15 million that builds on an already $60 million that have been secured for the H line. The H line runs from Minneapolis all the way to the Sunray Shopping Center, kind of east-west. But the funding, $25 million already in federal funds that came through our regional solicitation, and some of the funds already that has come from past state bonding requests. And we know that this additional $15 million could be really helpful matching funds for future federal grants. All in all, having these funds earlier allows us to prudently plan for these investments at the proper time and the proper place. So next slide, as I mentioned, it is east-west. It is north, in many cases, does the biggest amount of connections and work not in the metro areas. It's really a great service to the University of Minnesota, great service for the State Fair, for some of the sports leagues, and ultimately to the Sunray Shopping Center, where it makes great connections with these transit ways all along, like Sunray will really be where the Gold Line will have a major stop coming up in March. So with that, get right to our inflow and infiltration grant program.
Chair Zelli, before you go on, I just wanted to see if anybody has any questions about the busway, the $15
sure.
million.
We could take that in sections.
Where is Sunway?
It's just east of downtown St. Paul. It's
one
of the first stops. It's been a long-standing shopping center.
Okay. I had a question while I'm waiting to see if anyone else does. Oh, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Zelli. I'll agree that the BRT program has been great and successful, and excited to see additional BRT come online, especially the E-line. Very excited and anxious for that to be completed. It's having quite a bit of a negative consequences construction phase for the neighborhoods that I represent, particularly uptown. But my question is, and we'll have more conversation about this when we hear the Metro Transit budget presentation in Transportation Committee tomorrow. But I only ask this question because it's a question that's been posed to me. So you'll get to answer it a couple of times. Whereas you're requesting $15 million from capital investments for this purpose, at the same time the governor's budget proposal would turn back, if you will, $34 million per year, $68 million, I believe, over the biennium from Metro Transit's general fund allocation. So trying to square those two facts happening at the same time. On the one hand, you're giving back approaching $70 million over the biennium in general fund appropriation, it coming to capital investments for a $15 million bonding request. So how do I respond to that? How do I square that circle?
Chair Zelli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dibble, I think that's a great question, and I may even have a better answer tomorrow, but I believe that the capital proposal is really part of this long-term kind of commitment and formula that we have planned on, where the initial capital costs for these projects would come from local, state, and federal sources. And that with the funds derived not just from our current recurring funds that are dedicated, like the motor vehicle sales tax, but obviously the new metro sales tax allows us with enough funds to really cover operations, the structural deficit, the operations of a tremendously expanded transit system, and then importantly, the capital maintenance costs for operating that system. So if we look out and we have now a forecast of a 25-year kind of transportation finance report that really assumes the capital cost of these transitways covered by local, state, federal sources, but that the operations could be funded by our existing sources of funds. the 30-some million that we would be giving up of general funds was dedicated to rail operations. So although that is certainly something that we have an effect long-term for the transit systems, we believe that there's enough kind of operating revenue that we count on to cover and make the system sustainable in the near term. We know that it could come in the next 7 or 8, 9 years. It would maybe have an effect on the ability for us to expand the system. But given the strategic decisions that the governor has to make about balancing the calls on the general fund, I thought this was the right sacrifice to make at this time for this agency.
Double more.
I'll have more tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Elliott. A question. I've been hearing discussions about money at Met Council to be loaned to Minnesota DOT to help them build some capital projects. My question is, are you looking at shifting that money over to the DOT, and why not use that for these capital projects rather than going through the bonding bill?
Chair Zelli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pratt, the proposal, which I will also be happy to and be speaking to tomorrow in Transportation Committee, but it truly is a loan, not a grant. These are funds that make sense for us to transfer to MnDOT only for a period of time. The funds are needed, and so the plan contemplates those funds coming back to Met Council in order to cover the cost, primarily capital maintenance costs that will be coming due in the future. So rather than it being capital funds that are invested and don't come back, there's great benefits for both agencies to do road reconstruction and the capital cost of a transitway at the same time. That F line is funded. We know we're ready to go, but MnDOT does not have it in its plan during the time that we would want to build a transitway, and we thought it's best for our constituents not to have two capital projects and then the disruption, because they are disruptive. And Senator Dibble, I apologize for mentioning the E-line, which is very close to my heart because I also lived through that disruption, you know. But once they're completed, they have tremendous benefits. So the benefits could come sooner. The maintenance costs of reconstructing a road ahead of time was saved for MnDOT. But the funds are needed because as Met Council accumulates some reserves during this near-end period of time, we start hitting the true costs of capital maintenance, train replacements, platform investments, the state of good repair that covers funds that we require funds in those out years. So the thing we're here for now is capital funds that will stick with the project and not be repaid.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Zelli. As I understand it, we're talking that fund is in excess of $200 million. It seems to me that I don't know how much capital maintenance is going to cost you, and I think that would be an interesting piece, but it also seems like there's potentially some money that could offset the bonding request. And is it true that you're looking to charge the Minnesota DOT interest on this loan?
Chair Zelli.
Madam Chair and Senator, I know that the cost of money will have a charge. My understanding is if there is interest, it'd be very reasonable. The idea is to kind of have the, it would be certainly something that would be more beneficial to MnDOT than going out into and get additional outside bonding authority. Yes, $200 million is the kind of capital cost obligations that it takes. I mean, these are large systems, and if you go to other transit systems and legacy cities on the East Coast or the West Coast, you'll see what deferred maintenance and huge capital costs that go unattended can bear to customers, to a city, and with the idea and commitment to keep these systems in good repair, I think would really benefit the metro area, the systems, and ultimately, kind of like with our wastewater system, becomes much more efficient from a cost point of view over time as well.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I'll leave the rest of this discussion for Senator Dibble in his Transportation Committee. Let me just say I'm a little concerned that what basically becomes a temporary inter-agency transfer is going to generate some sort of interest when the money is sitting there not being used today. That interest ends up costing taxpayers, ends up costing MnDOT more than they borrowed, and I think we have to be more cognizant of the impact to taxpayers in the metropolitan area.
Chair Zelli, if you have a surplus in your fund, would you normally have that in an investment account of some kind?
Yes, Madam Chair, we would have it in reserves that has interest-bearing accounts, obviously low risk, but certainly creates funds. Plus, to Senator Pratt's point, the taxpayer perspective could be that we have additional funds. I don't have that analysis with me, but we can show the financial benefit to taxpayers by having these roadway construction done earlier. Not just the cost of less disruption of only having one project, not two, but there's the most expensive part of a roadway is when it's old and has potholes and needs continuous work. And once it's reconstruction, it becomes a much more efficient, less costly roadway. So we actually think this plan would save taxpayers a substantial amount of money.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Zelli, I just wanted to give a kind of a follow-up on Senator Pratt's comments. I've been just wondering in the back of my mind how it can be that the Met Council has extracted such a surplus from the taxpayers. And so I have two questions, a question and then a comment. How much is that? So would it be fair to say that, and I don't represent people who live in the Met Council, but I do get concerned when governments tax or overtax or have additional tax revenues that they've collected from Minnesota taxpayers. So I'm concerned, too, one, how much is that? How much have they been overtaxed? And then secondly, it seems it just really rubs me wrong to think that the government is taking more money than what it needs from taxpayers, and then it might be gaining interest on that money. And we know the value of money over time, but it seems like the taxpayers are getting left out of this. So how much are you talking about here?
Chair Zelli.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, I don't have the figure in front of me, but we can provide that. And we had planned to have that tomorrow, but I can give that to you afterwards. I actually think, as I mentioned to Senator Pratt, that it isn't the taxpayers' best interest because we look at the full life cycle of these very significant assets. And my understanding over my years in business, you actually can't just measure what the cost is in any particular year. It's what the cost is over time. And if over time you're saving money by doing proper maintenance and capital investments, and if you're operating efficiently over time, that's in everybody's long-term interest. And that is why for our financial report, we provide a 25-year forecast to show exactly when reserves are built and then when those reserves are spent. And so that will be spent. The question is, in the near term, we have those reserves in interest-bearing accounts. Having proper sinking funds and reserves for significant asset investments is a standard private sector, public sector protocol in order to protect taxpayer and investor interests.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I am well aware of sinking funds, but my question is, it appears to me that the money was for the Met Council to develop Met Council resources or prepare for the future or keep things maintained as necessary. That's all important. But apparently now it's being, and I also like where it's being redirected to, which is roads and bridges. But it just appears that there was some miscalculation in how to prepare or how to fund these projects. And I'll wait to learn about the Met Council's budget more later, but it just doesn't seem right that we would tax Minnesotans for the long-term sinking funds for important projects, and then we redirect it over here, or it's bearing interest, which I understand is part of those sinking funds, but it just doesn't have a very good feel to it. So I will look forward to getting your information tomorrow.
I'll take that as a statement. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. We're gonna, and I'm super happy. I'm very glad, pleased that Senator Nelson is on the Transportation Committee, and we're gonna have the hearing on the Met Council's budget tomorrow. And I'm familiar with this loan proposal, Met Council loan to MnDOT. But I haven't delved into the particulars or the details. I'll do that tonight, so I'll be really ready for the hearing tomorrow. Or the presentation, not really hearing. And I just wanted to offer, Madam Chair, a slightly different perspective from what I understand of the proposal, which is, I think, a good thing, because I think a problem that we've had in the past, I can cite the example of the Hiawatha Bridge overpass over Lake Street, where that was built. And, you know, it was, you know, somewhat known that at some point transit would be traveling along Hiawatha. And I think a lot of people assumed that that bridge would then be ready for LRT just to, you know, be put on the bridge. Well, it turns out that wasn't the case. And so when the Hiawatha line, we call the Blue Line, was built a few years later, they had to build their own bridge structure, and it was really expensive. And so to have this kind of conversation dynamically happening with MnDOT as they're going through and doing a roadway project that ultimately is going to receive a transit facility to make sure that roadway project is ready for that is I think, a level of interaction and communication and more holistic transit planning and getting that infrastructure in place more timely and in a beneficial way. That you know, to Chair Zelli's point, allows us to get ahead of, and we know that construction inflation exceeds the consumer price index, and you know, transit inflation especially so. So we beat the inflation calculation. Mm-hmm. We get ourselves ready for future transit, we have more holistic planning process that occurs, and so I think this is a good thing. And you know, I don't think it's a terrible thing necessarily that you know, the sales tax dollars that are being collected are also being programmed out into the future. So the sinking fund idea, I don't think, is an overcollection. You know, the dollars that we're collecting in the sales tax is to build out you know, a very, very robust system. Not of all of which can be built today, because there's just simply the inability and the capacity to build everything all at once. So to bank some of those dollars for future construction is also prudent. It's not an overtaxation, and it's not holding on to an extraordinary level of reserves. You know, and to the extent that we do see that, you know, I think we would address it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, members, for the discussion. I'd like to actually ask Chair Zelli to move on now to I&I, and we'll tune in to transportation tomorrow to hear the next episode.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and I will look forward to tomorrow's discussion as well. But this is about our water, wastewater system, And as you all know, we operate the Metro wastewater system out of 9 plants. And you think about the number of the interstate system, the network of pipes, interceptors, and lift stations throughout the metro with these various plants. We are taking the water from municipalities, which ultimately take wastewater from homes. And the challenge, of course, is on the next slide, it's these connecting pipes, which often are in the state of disrepair. And kind of much like highways, when you invest and put them in better shape, they not only save funds, but they save, in this case, save water. There's tremendous leakage. This is truly leakage, as in water leakage, of our stormwater systems that create inefficient systems. So this grant program has been very successful, where we are able to provide funds through municipalities to help reduce their municipal inefficient pipe systems. And generally, we provide these funds as a matching grant program. So the recommendation is at $4.6 million. We've been doing this for a number of years, so I think you're very familiar with it. It's very popular with cities, certainly. They have aging infrastructure, even though the Metro Council system is in really a state of good repair because we stay on it. But I think the funds and the infrastructure funds have been lacking at the municipal level and in many cases the home level. So here's the 80 cities and townships that are impacted. There's actually a formula of measure. If a flow rate is within 20% of an allowable limit, then they become eligible. Many people have asked, is there a need even greater? And there certainly is. But we feel that we're very grateful that the legislature has really consistently funded this program, because it's kind of kept pace with contractors with the capacities to kind of keep this program going on an ongoing kind of work. And so we're asking for that allocation this year.
Chair Zelli, it seemed to me over the last couple years that this program has been underfunded and under-requested by the Met Council and under-recommended by the governor. Can you give me any kind of sense of what the amount of request is out there?
Madam Chair, I don't know what the need is compared to the contractor's capacity. Those are really two different numbers. But we do know that, yes, there is greater need. I do know that the governor has recommended funding continuously. Should he have recommended more, that is up to his judgment, balancing the other needs that the state has for capital funds. But I think that this is certainly a significant amount of money that can continue to advance the program.
What comes to mind is from our tour is Newport, with a very dynamic mayor. I wanted to nominate her for Mayor of the Year. She was so good, so persuasive and enthusiastic, so I still remember her. Right. They probably could use the 4.6 themselves, because they had a tremendous leakage problem, INI problem. So I think this is an area, I can't remember what we were going to recommend last year, but this is certainly an area that is important to the metropolitan legislators.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, we can give you a range of what we think the need is, but it's a little, that gets into a little bit of science. We're not sure we're fully committed.
There's really a shortage of contractors to do this work?
I don't think it's a question of shortage of contractors, but it is specialized work that those that are really adept at it, there is a limited number.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on the INI issue? Okay, why don't you move on?
Their third and final program is Regional Parks and Trails Bonding Program. This is one that also has had regular, consistent funding. It really makes a difference for the implementing agencies, the regional park systems around the metro area. This is also important to mention that the council provides two-thirds match to all state funds. Mm-hmm. So we actually take this $2.3 million and provide an additional $1.53 million in regional funds, which come from our very small property tax that comes to the council. And we distribute it across the region by a formula, and I can jump really to that. You can see all the parks and the trail systems here, 58 regional parks out of our 10 implementing agencies. Quite an extraordinary system, and all those implementing agencies really agree upon the formula. They're very enthusiastic. I think if they were here, they would say we need more, and we recognize that. But we think with the consistent state allocations and then Met Council matching the funds, that these become meaningful investments.
And of course, all the members are invited to the Pappas Pizza Party, Parks Pizza Party that we normally have. Just a little reminder, we haven't scheduled it yet, but you know, to be determined.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate those senators who came and saw some of the park field trips we've had. We actually looked at, was it bison? Yeah, anyway.
But yes.
Quite remarkable.
In Dakota County.
In Newport County. We have a tremendous variety of park systems throughout the entire metro, which have seen more and more use.
Well, that also seems a little low to me, that amount, but so we'll see. Any questions about the metropolitan parks, regional parks and trails? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming. Members, and thank you.
Next on our agenda, the Bob Meyer and Sam Minkler from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. It's a pleasure to be here today. Commissioner Stroman expresses her regrets for not being here, but she's tied up in another engagement right now. With me, I have Samantha Minkler, our Capital Asset Program Manager, who many of you probably recognize from the tours that you've been on. She does a great job coordinating and providing information. And I'm going to have her run through our presentation today.
And the commissioners joined us on much of our tours as well.
Definitely. It's always a pleasure.
And you and I explored carps.
That was a fun day.
It was cold. Ms. Minkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'll give a quick overview of our assets, and then we'll get started with our bonding proposal. The DNR manages and maintains public land and infrastructure on behalf of Minnesotans, providing countless benefits to our state. Our assets serve Minnesotans across the state and are a part of the fabric of communities. Caring for these assets requires a systematic and comprehensive approach. The infrastructure programs and projects in our bonding proposal contribute in direct and dynamic ways towards advancing our agency mission, which is to work with Minnesotans to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, to provide outdoor recreation opportunities, and to provide for commercial uses of natural resources in a way that creates a sustainable quality of life. DNR assets are diverse and unlike many other state assets. And as you know from our bonding tours, you may have visited any of these. The state park campground or cabin where Minnesotans spend their summer vacations, host family reunions, and picnics, school trips, weddings, and meetups for hiking, bird watching, winter activities, and the list goes on. The public fishing pier where a child catches their first fish, and the fish hatchery where that fish was raised for stocking. the native prairie that supports pheasants, songbirds, and pollinators while improving water quality and capturing carbon. State forests and the roads that provide access to them that support wildlife habitat, recreation, climate mitigation, and the forest products economy. And of course, the DNR offices where people can buy a fishing license, submit a permit application, or get information about natural resources in their community. In addition to our diverse asset types, our assets are extensive and geographically dispersed across all 87 counties and 5.6 million acres of land. DNR-built assets have a current replacement value of $3.5 billion, and stewardship of these assets requires ongoing repair, renovation, and replacement. We have a deferred maintenance challenge. The number, variety, and condition and age of our facilities all contribute to a significant capital need for asset preservation. As you can see in this graph, asset preservation appropriations, which are shown by the blue line at the bottom, have been far short of what's needed to address the deferred maintenance backlog, shown by the green bars that are increasing over time. As a result, the need keeps growing. Nearly one in four buildings are in unacceptable or poor condition. Only one in four buildings meets today's design and building standards, including accessibility. And nearly one in three buildings are over 80 years old. In 2025, we are looking to continue to address these deferred maintenance needs and make other targeted and community investments. Given DNR's size and scope of custodial responsibilities, it is necessary to strike a balance between system-wide programmatic investments and targeted projects and community investments. This systematic approach focuses on prioritizing the greatest needs and efficiently completing capital investment projects. Our 2025 bonding request is grouped into these three categories, and projects are listed in priority order. We'll go through each project in more detail, and our total request is $98 million. In 2025, natural resources asset preservation, which we abbreviate NRAP, remains our top capital investment priority, and we request $61 million for projects including repair, renovation, or replacement of degraded or failing infrastructure. Our NRAP infrastructure categories include building components and site infrastructure, water and wastewater systems, roads, trails, and bridges, public water access sites, campsites, group camps, shower buildings, day use areas and vault toilets, fish hatcheries, and water control structures. Asset preservation investments ensure that our infrastructure is safe and functional for the public, supports conservation of Minnesota's natural resources, and preserves the state's investments in its capital assets. We consider design factors such as accessibility, energy efficiency, and climate resiliency in this work. Next, we request $11.1 million for the Betterment of Buildings program. Our top priority for this program is adding needed storage capacity and examination facilities for mineral exploration samples at the Hibbing Drill Corps Library. This project is designed complete and ready for bidding. Betterment is an important complement to NRAP or asset preservation funding. Asset preservation addresses the backlog of deferred maintenance needs that affects the safety, usability, and effectiveness of DNR-managed facilities and infrastructure. And betterment funding allows for the substantial improvement or addition to or replacement of buildings that fail to meet current needs or have reached the end of their useful life. These programs are critical to address our substantial infrastructure needs.
Ms. Minkler, with the Drill Corps Library, which we did visit, can't that be stored like electronically in some way? I mean, those drill cores take up a lot of room, which is why you need the expansion. Why do we have to actually have the physical drill core? Do you know?
Madam Chair, if I may interject a little bit. There has been research and projects that have taken place where they've scanned those cores electronically, and we're trying to evaluate how that would really work. But this is an asset, as you know, it's a geologist's dream come true. This storage of our geological information in this library, is invaluable, and people come from all over the world to look at it. So while we are exploring other ways to utilize it, storing that core, which companies are required to present to us, is critically important as well, making sure it's accessible. We can provide more information on that to the committee as well.
Thank you. Any other questions for now? Then why don't you continue?
Thank you. So with the Joe Corps, our highest priority, we also have, we just want to note, we still have funding needs that remain for constructing a plug seedling facility at the State Forest Nursery. High priority replacements are unsafe or inadequate DNR offices and storage spaces, and constructing new or significantly modernized visitor centers, picnic shelters, trail centers, camper cabins, and shower buildings.
We funded the fish hatchery partially, I think. What's going on with that, do you know?
Madam Chair, correct. You funded the Waterville hatchery last year, $20 million, and mm-hmm. that project is in pre-design right now, that's wrapping up, and then it will go into design.
So $20 million, does that cover everything? Does that cover the construction too?
They are finalizing the budget, the final budget estimate for that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Next is our Acquisition and Betterment of Public Lands Program. The 2025 capital request of $6.5 million focuses on reforestation and other land improvement efforts, enhancing access, quality, and safety on DNR-managed state lands, and acquisition of strategic high-priority inholdings and parcels. Capital funding for public lands improves and conserves Minnesota's natural heritage, enriches public outdoor recreational opportunities, and provides for sustainable commercial uses of natural resources. This also contributes to climate mitigation and adaptation goals as well.
Senator Dipple, then Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see the third bullet point, acquire new high priority parcels. Can we learn a little bit more about what those parcels are and what their intended use. What I'm really asking is, Madam Chair, are we targeting any of those parcels for state parks in light of the fact that, you know, we've decommissioned two state parks in recent years, we've acquired a lot of property the DNR has, but none of that has been for state parks. We're seeing our state park system shrink and we're not adding to it in any way. And state parks, of course, have a unique profile, as was described in the opening comments, in terms of our state's recreational and preservation and conservation needs. So how are we thinking about acquiring land by the DNR, especially as it relates to state parks? Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we love our state parks, but we also have an asset preservation issue. Right, Ms. Minkler.
Madam Chair, may I address
that? Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, thank you for that excellent question. As Ms. Minkler spoke, these are to address inholdings within our state park and our recreation systems. Oftentimes, these are generational opportunities that come up where people may have lived within the state park boundaries for generations, and their ultimate desire is to have that become part of the state park. We can provide the committee a list of what we're looking at for these inholdings, but there's no establishment of new state parks at this point in time within this recommendation.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions were along the same line as Senator Dibble's about the acquiring of new high priority parcels. So I'll look forward to getting more about what that is. And I do understand the generational opportunities when there's land that's inside mm-hmm. or next to existing state parks. But I did notice, just a little bit off on a different thought here, that the DNR has 11% of our state land currently. If I understood your slide correctly, 11% of Minnesota is DNR state land. Is that correct? I saw that on one of your earlier slides, or if that's not what it means, please tell me. It says 5.6 million acres of land, which is 11% of Minnesota's total land area. Mm-hmm. The DNR is in all 87 counties. So is that correct?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, yes. That land encompasses many different varieties. 2.7 million acres of that are school trust fund lands mm-hmm. that we manage for the benefit of the school trust to fund our educational programs. There are state forests, there are state parks. We have 1.5 million acres of wildlife management areas that are included in that number as well. So we will provide a breakdown of those lands for you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have much of that breakdown already. And the one thing I wanted to just note is that one of the issues that certainly has been discussed in some of our other committees is the fact that when we take lands out of private hands or family hands or business, and it becomes something wonderful, a state park, for example, it is removed from the tax rolls. And some of our counties have more land that is not taxable than is taxable. And so this is causing some challenges for some counties when the majority of that or large portions of the land are no longer on the tax rolls. And I know we have things like PILT, which we payment in lieu of taxes for that. But it is, I think it is something we have to bear in mind as we go forward, that there does come a point where we need to think about very seriously and carefully before we would expand into new areas. I certainly would take exception to the generational opportunities. I definitely understand that. But so just a comment from other thoughts as far as expansion and the effect of removing those lands from the property tax of those communities or those areas.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Just returning to the point I just made, I actually didn't appreciate how much land the DNR currently owns, 5.6 million acres. I think state parks are somewhat less than a grand total of 235,000 acres. So we might not actually have to purchase additional lands. I mean, 235,000 acres is for about 4% of 5.6 million acres. So I would just encourage the DNR to take a look at our state parks, our state park system, the fact that it's shrinking. And you know, it is probably the most heavily used, heavily visited, most highly prized and valued aspect of the entire DNR system. And so I would like to continue this conversation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
As long as we're talking about state parks, why don't you give us, Mr. Meyer, a little update on our newest state park, Vermilion. I was there, I think, in 21 on the bonding tour. I don't believe we went there in 23. So how's it going?
Madam Chair, members, thank you for heading up there and visiting. I believe at that point you probably saw some of the newer camper cabins and
yes,
the group camping areas that were going there. Mm-hmm. We're still building out the facilities, trying to determine fund availability versus the entire system and how do we build that out while maintaining, looking at other opportunities as well. So I could provide some new pictures and things like that with mm-hmm. our response to the committee as we come back to you all with our questions.
Great. And I think we have some more. Mrs. Minkler.
Yes, thank you. All right. Our next project is improving accessibility of DNR managed lands and facilities. Our 2025 request of $1.9 million will allow us to continue to make progress to provide more comprehensive accessibility improvements at state parks and recreation areas and high visitation wildlife management areas. Comprehensive accessibility improvements help advance DNR's strategic priorities of connecting people to the outdoors and expanding diversity, equity, and inclusion. These types of improvements may include improving the accessibility of bathrooms, parking areas, showers, campsites, trails, day use areas, interpretive facilities, and hunting blinds. Providing new amenities to meet the needs of an increasingly diverse user base with a variety of physical abilities and skills, and improving signage and interpretive exhibits when part of a larger renovation. The community investment projects in our 2025 request include, and this is new for 2025, the Dam Safety Grant Program requests $10 million to fund the rapid and dam recovery efforts, which may include stabilization of the steep, unsafe riverbank or funds for dam removal. These requests also include $5.6 million for the Flood Hazard Mitigation Grant Program. This program provides cost share grants to local governments, including cities, counties, and watershed districts for projects that reduce flood risk. This funding is critical in the face of the changing climate. And finally, we request $1.9 million for the Parks and Trails Local and Regional Grant Program, which provides competitive grants to local governments for acquisition and development of local parks and trails across Minnesota. These grant programs allow DNR to partner with local communities to acquire land and develop parks and trails that help create a network of close-to-home recreation facilities. And we just have a quick slide here to show how our capital investment funding is put to good use. We utilize an efficient and effective capital asset management program to deploy the funding we receive toward the highest priority preservation and improvement projects across Minnesota. As you can see here, our 2023 NRAP projects are underway in communities across the state. And our list of highest priority needs is regularly updated based on the latest information. In this way, new events such as unexpected failure of building components or storm damage can be addressed. Regular and consistent capital investment funding is essential to the success of our asset management program and will help us tackle the backlog of deferred maintenance over the years to come. In summary, the DNR's 2025 bonding request will help us maintain and preserve the essential natural resources infrastructure that benefits Minnesotans across the state. Our proposal focuses on taking care of what we have while advancing strategic priorities to serve current and future generations. Thank you, and we'll stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions, members of the committee? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. And we have a letter following this from the Nature Conservancy. I just wanted to call that out to members. Our next presentation is from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Alexis Donath.
Madam Chair and members, apologies for the delay.
That's all right. It takes a while to get the technology connected, so welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members, and thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Alexis Donath, and I serve as Legislative Coordinator for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Commissioner Kessler sends her regrets for not being able to join us today. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's capital budget request for 2025 is rooted in our agency's mission to protect and improve the environment and human health. And I have just one project to discuss with you today, but it is an important one. The governor's capital budget for 2025 includes a recommended $8 million in general obligation bonds for grants to communities with contaminated drinking water. Private wells in Andover, Gem Lake, and some manufactured home parks statewide are polluted at levels that may pose a serious risk to human health. People with contaminated wells are currently being provided with bottled water, but this is a costly short-term fix to a long-term problem. More permanent fixes are needed, such as connecting residents to city water or, in some locations, digging a deeper well or other solutions. These residents are not eligible for conventional funding for drinking water infrastructure improvements since they are on private wells. The need for these funds is great, and the need far exceeds available dollars. This budget recommendation provides funding to construct long-term solutions for the current highest priority site on MPCA's list. It also establishes parameters and criteria for a grant program that can be used in the future to address similar situations. At this time, the highest priority project for this grant program is located in the Red Oaks neighborhood of Andover. Levels of PFAS and 1,4-dioxane in private wells in this neighborhood exceed health-based values set by the Minnesota Department of Health. This is the second phase of a two-phase project. In 2024, 93 out of 94 homes in the phase one area were connected to municipal water at a cost of $6.1 million. This phase was funded by the 2023 bonding bill, and we do wish to thank members for inclusion of that project in that bonding bill. Residents in the phase two area of the neighborhood are currently receiving bottled water on an emergency basis. This is a quick fix, but it's not cost effective. The long-term solution in this case is to add a drinking water line to connect this neighborhood to Andover City Water. Bonding dollars would be used only for the portion of the project in the public right of way. This would provide water service to 96 homes. In the phase two area of Red Oaks, PFAS pollution is the primary issue rather than 1,4-dioxane. We've never met a pollutant like PFAS before, and I'd like to take just a moment to talk about it. PFAS forever chemicals were widely used for decades and are commonly found in consumer products. They're extremely stable and do not break down in the environment. 2023 legislation known as Amara's Law will reduce the use of PFAS in consumer goods over time, but we still live with its legacy and will for a very long time. Andover is just one place where residents are being impacted by that legacy of pollution. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, PFAS is associated with a number of health impacts, including immune suppression, cancer, liver problems, and developmental and reproductive effects. PFAS can be harmful even in very small amounts because of the way these forever chemicals build up in our bodies and in the environment over time. It is very difficult and very expensive to remove PFAS through water treatment technologies. Again, the Andover residents in this phase two area are currently on private well water. There have been no detections of PFAS at levels that exceed health standards in Andover's city water, and so connecting Red Oaks residents to city water is the best recommended solution at this time. So again, in summary, the governor's recommendation is for $8 million in general obligation bonds and for policy language to establish a grant process and grant criteria in statute. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I am happy to stand for questions.
So, Ms. Donath, let me wrap my head around this. So, the Red Oaks neighborhood is part of Andover, but they're not connected to the municipal water system. They have private wells. Private wells have become contaminated.
Madam Chair and members, that is correct. The Red Oaks neighborhood is located in Andover. The residents in this area have private wells, and we've discovered PFAS contamination in a number of those wells.
And to connect them to the municipal system, this is what the $8 million would do, would connect them to the municipal system.
Madam Chair and members, the $8 million would construct the portion of the line that is in the public right-of-way.
Public right-of-way. So they still would have to get to the public right-of-way. But it's $8 million for 96 homes?
Madam Chair, that is correct. I am joined by our Assistant Commissioner, Kirk Kudelka. He may be able to provide some more information on that.
Yeah, please join us in, on this issue. Do you want to ask? Okay, Senator Housley.
I'll wait.
You'll wait. Okay. Mr. Kukalka.
Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The issue here is we do look at various alternatives to hooking up communities, and because there is a large majority here, we look at not only the cost of other alternative treatment systems, but also the long-term operation costs. If we were to provide individual home treatments in each of these homes, we would have not only that upfront capital costs, but we would have ongoing operation and maintenance costs of those, compared to if we go to municipal water, where we just have the capital cost. The cost of water would then be paid for by the residents. In addition, by connecting this whole home, and we will also reduce the need for us to keep monitoring in the area. And then, unfortunately, because of PFAS and more stringent PFAS values, it is likely more homes will have to be connected in the future. So by doing this as a neighborhood, as a whole, we're able to reduce ongoing operation costs to the state and also ongoing monitoring and sampling costs, too.
So you have the upfront infrastructure costs, but what's the potential? How many other homes are there out there that with private wells that could also be contaminated? Do we have any sense of that?
Chair and committee members, we know that there's 41 right now with exceedances. We're continuing to monitor in that area. It's going to depend on a few pieces of information. One is the plume moving and our standards changing. A couple years ago, our standards and best known science would have had lesser or fewer homes being impacted, but because we know PFAS and its human health impacts happen at even lower amounts, more people are impacted. And so we know that as we've studied more and more about PFAS, we have just learned that even lower amounts are a risk. So we want to connect this whole area now, so even those that may be currently under the guidance levels or detection levels are protected from the future where we may see changes.
So is Andover near a 3M plant? How do they get contaminated by PFAS? Do you have any idea?
Chair and committee members, we're investigating a number of sources. PFAS, unfortunately, is more than just the companies that use it. We manufacture it like 3M. We find it in a number of industries, whether it's plating, companies, firefighting foam locations, industrial locations. There is a known Superfund site just to the south, which we're working with EPA and the responsible party group there is doing sampling to try to see if the 1,4-dioxin and the PFAS is connected to that site. So that is the goal right now. We have done reviews of a closed landfill just to the north and northeast, and have found actually the contamination moves away from this neighborhood towards the creek that's on the other side of the landfill.
Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Donath or Mr. Kadelka, didn't we in 2023, and maybe you know this, Senator Pappas, didn't we fund Andover and the PFAS? Yeah, what neighborhood did that go to and how much was that again? Because I can't remember what we did.
Ms. Donath.
Madam Chair and Senator Housley, I can pull up this map again. So those 2023 dollars, that $6.1 million, went to fund phase one of the project. And I believe that is on the east side of the blue block that you see in the middle of this slide. And I believe that was around 94 homes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Housley.
Thank you. So that was $6.1 million in 2023, and then this is $8 million 2025 ask. Is there any other neighborhoods in that area that you see as maybe a potential hazard?
Chair and committee members, we unfortunately have seen this to be too familiar, and that's why we are proposing creating a larger program to be able to fund locations like this. A Gem Lake is another location within the Twin Cities that we see the same risk. And in Andover also at Eastbrook Terrace, which is further to the west, we have discovered 1,4-dioxin and PFAS. These are later on our priority list. This we believe will be a growing list as we continue to do our work. But these are the projects that we know are ready at this time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Housley.
Thank you. And of the $6.1 million in 2023, was that enough to cover that neighborhood, or how, and was all that funding used?
Chair and committee members, the 6.1 was used for the water mains and the individual home connections to their homes for just shy of 100 homes. And those were the ones we were first prioritized because that was the 1-4 accident where we had seen the most exceedances. However, the western portion of the Red Oaks neighborhood, we continue to call the monitoring zone, and we've been monitoring that. And it's with through that monitoring we have found additional results for PFAS, and also the more stringent health values coming out have meant more people are impacted over those health-based values than previously.
Thank you.
Here's the landfill, and here's the Superfund.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other members have questions? All right. Thank you. I just feel like this is not enough. I mean, $8 million, just the tip, sounds like it's just the tip of the iceberg. And the governor's not recommending for Hastings, and that's certainly, they weren't included in the lawsuit funding for that community. And there's probably dozens more. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. Go ahead and why don't you introduce yourselves to the committee and for the tape, and then proceed.
Yeah, thank you. I'm John Jasky, Executive Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, or Bowser, as we're typically referred to. And this is Andrea Fish, our Assistant Director.
Welcome.
Thank you. And we'll begin. I will introduce the beginning of the presentation, just an overview of our agency. We work all of our programs and projects through local governments, through counties, cities, watershed districts, stormwater conservation districts, even townships once in a while. We also have some other partners in some areas of our work, not in the areas of our capital investment program. So these are all carried out and delivered by, for, and with local governments. We also work all of our projects on private lands, and you'll see that the common denominator here is that we are doing that with on a state asset called a conservation easement as the thing that we are ultimately acquiring with these dollars. You can flip to the next slide. These are the two items, and I will just highlight a couple of things that are common denominators for each of them. One is that they're both statewide programs, and so we use these funds all over the state of Minnesota and have been doing so for a couple of decades in both cases. They are both statutory programs that have a basis in law. In one case, it's a requirement. In the other case, it's more of an opportunity with some conditions about how we go about doing that. They're all both focused on wetlands, the restoration of wetlands in particular. As I mentioned before, the way we accomplish that is, of course, through a number of biological and engineering design criteria that ultimately lead to preservation of these areas for the multiple benefits they provide, including habitat, clean water, et cetera. So I'll have Ms. Fish cover the first item.
Greetings, Madam Chair and members. My name, again, is Andrea Fish, Assistant Director at the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Our first bonding ask in front of you today is the Local Government Roads Wetland Replacement Program. As Director Jasky mentioned, this program is statutorily obligated for the agency to oversee the replacement of wetlands that would otherwise be impacted by local government road projects. Having this centralized within the state at the Bowser level allows us to plan and execute larger and higher quality wetland replacement projects. And these are traditionally more cost effective, and we can do expedited permitting for local governments when they are planning out these projects. We do this program throughout 10 bank service areas across the state of Minnesota. And as we're looking ahead, and have been looking ahead, we do know that there are some bank service areas in particular where we are projecting a deficit in available wetland credits as part of this program. So we want to make sure that we are being mindful and proactive so that there is a stable and known source of wetland credits for local governments. Generating and releasing wetland credits for availability is a long-term public project. It can take 8 to 10 years from initial appropriation to final credit release after the time of planning and selecting a project that would accommodate the program, conducting the design and the construction, and then monitoring that before releasing the credits for availability. So for local governments, we do want this funding to be based on credit needs 3 to 10 years in the future for them to know that they can undertake their local project. As we've noted already, we are projecting a deficit in available credits for local governments, and we did very recently pull together a work group of members of local government communities, transportation, engineering, and others to talk through how this program might be used and how we can ensure a stable and predictable funding source for the program. I do believe this work group has provided a one-page fact sheet, high-level overview for you of what they analyzed and the results of that analysis. And there is a longer report available on Bowser's website as well.
So the issue with the local roads wetland replacement program is that if you don't have the, if we don't fund it, then we're really holding up road improvements in rural Minnesota, right? Because they rely on this program to get the funds so that you're replacing the wetlands that are lost with the road construction. If you don't have the funds to replace the wetlands, then the road construction can't proceed. Do I have that right?
Madam Chair, yes, is the short answer. Mm-hmm. The longer answer is a little bit twofold. One is if there are no credits within a bank service area, the local government has the opportunity to purchase credits from a different bank service area. Mm-hmm. But that is at a higher cost due to purchasing from a separate bank service area. So it can add a cost to a project, even if it is approved. And then, of course, if we did not have wetland credits at all within the state, yes, that would interfere with the ability to plan out and execute a local government road project.
And have you run out of the credits then in throughout the state or just in certain areas like your chart?
Madam Chair, statewide we have not run out of credits. Within certain bank service areas, there has been occasional historic deficit.
Can you explain how that credit system works and how that's related to how we fund the program?
I can maybe cover that one, Madam Chair. It ties back to the regulatory programs, both at the state and federal level. And so road authorities, of course, you know, are subject to those. And in order to get a permit from either a federal or a local or state authority to do a road project that's going to impact a wetland, there's a requirement that they offset or mitigate or replace that wetland somewhere else. And so this is the way that's accomplished for all local government road projects for all of those permitting jurisdictions. And so there's a method to all of this that's been in place for now 25 or so years to do that. And we have a partnership with MnDOT that also, you know, so we do this together, and that covers their state projects as well. As last year, when we were in front of this committee, Senator Dibble asked us to look at what we could do to try and identify and then perhaps do something about this projected shortfall, which you can see in the information here. That group got together, and as Ms. Fish indicated, you know, analyzed the situation and understood that it was an estate obligation that would go into default if the state didn't provide these funds at a sufficient and timely basis. And their conclusion was that there's really no good idea other than that this has been the traditional source, the bonding appropriation, for those 20-some years, and that's probably the best place for it to be in this current year as well. So that's a short summary of that, Madam Chair.
So the idea of the credit program is then it doesn't have to be replaced in that particular area or county. It can be replaced somewhere else in the state.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And maybe more importantly, that it doesn't fall onto the responsibility of that local road authority to try and go make or find or build these wetlands for mm-hmm. individual projects. You know, and there's many, many hundreds of those each year. And this is a much more efficient way to do it, right. And of course much more effective from an ecological perspective too, because you can build a really nice site as opposed to trying to fit it into a road right away or something like that.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Do you want to proceed with the next program? Oh, Senator Dibble.
So My basic question is $3.6 million seems pretty, do we have the identified need? I was just-
$26 million.
Yeah.
I think there's another handout here that talks about the need. So it's a good question.
Okay, so, to overcome the credit deficit requires an appropriation of $26 million. So, all right, we got a ways to go. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if there are any other questions on this topic, I'll continue on to the second item then. We can always come back if there are additional ones. This next component is we call it the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, which is actually a federal term. When we use our state program, the Reinvest in Minnesota, which is a statutory program that directs us to acquire conservation easements on typically on marginal lands and restore those back, and wetlands are the primary objective that we accomplish with that. We have a federal agreement in place with USDA that was originally signed in 2015, and now we just this year, just actually last month, that agreement was expanded and extended to cover more of Minnesota and as well as additional amount of acres that can be included in that agreement. And it also helped us with, you know, adding a practice that was not previously allowed, which was the areas that now allow us to secure these lands for private drinking water protection benefits. We were previously limited to just focusing on public water supply areas. And then also you can see here that the federal, the state funding leverage is also adjusted to a ratio that's basically a 70-30 ratio of federal to state funding. This is something that is authorized and then connected to the federal farm bill, which of course is in a status of being considered for a renewal. You know, it's expected that that will happen at some point in time. And of course, with the announcement late last night about the federal pause, that affects lots of different things. It you know, would affect this potentially too, although we're certainly expecting that the CRP program, which it's based on, will continue in future years. It has been in place since 1985. This just shows, Madam Chair, the next slide, the funding that we've used to date, the past funding. We received these funds from various sources, and you can see here over the last, you know, 9 years or so, we were able to use these state funds to generate about $350 million of federal investment in Minnesota. That funding goes to landowners, to contractors that are both doing the work, the design teams and so forth that are part of that. We use our Soil and Water Conservation District network to identify landowners who might be interested, and they also provide that sort of person in the field to help us with working with those landowners and talking them through the legal aspects of the real estate transaction as well as some of the pre-design work.
Mr. Jackie, is the $9.3 million the minimum that you need to match the federal funds? Is there a matching requirement?
Madam Chair, the matching requirement is more of the opportunity. For every dollar we put in, we get, you know, $3 that go in, we get $7 back. So there, obviously, if you don't have any, if you have don't have enough to get it to work and at a scale that's meaningful, of course, it would probably be a limit on that side of it. But it's a statewide program, so we, you know, we need enough funding to make it in fact statewide.
Mm-hmm. So the 9.3 would open up 18 million approximately for federal funds. Did you say it's like a 1-2 or 1-3 match?
And I'm sure I'm having a hard time doing math in my head, but
I know, me too.
For every,
right.
If you give us a 9, I guess, you know, you have to do the math on that, but you multiply it by the 7-3 ratio, and that'll give you the number.
Yeah, okay. Any questions? Mr. Jackie and Ms. Fish, you have a number of projects that were in the cancellation report. Can you talk about that at all? We have in flood disaster relief, RIM, and then RIM a little bit from 2012, very small amount from conservation easements, 2015, a larger amount from 2019 bonding.
Yeah,
so the total is about $976,600. dollars.
Madam Chair, I think those are all accurate and correct. We were going to ask our CFO, but she is out of country on vacation until tomorrow, so we will double check that. We have a meeting actually scheduled to do that very thing, and we'll let you know if any of those have a question or a discrepancy that we think needs further attention.
And otherwise, they'll be canceled.
Correct.
Right.
Madam Chair, generally those are smaller amounts that add up from RIM purchases that tend to not meet the estimated amount if we're able to purchase at a lower price than we'd anticipated. So they do tend to be smaller projects within around $10,000 to $50,000 that add up.
So you're not requesting any money for the RIM program, just for the conservation easement program? Are they, how are they different?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's a very good question. They basically are the same thing in this instance. The federal program is called the CREP program, and we use our state authority under the Reinvest in Minnesota statute to pair with that to make it a federal. We could call it CREP RIM, but you know, it's like it gets to be too many letters in a row there. So it's a federal opportunity using a state authority to accomplish it.
All right. Thank you very much, then.
Thank you.
And then we're on to our last presentation, which is the Department of Human Services. Welcome, if you want to introduce yourselves for the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Nancy Freeman. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Direct Care and Treatment, which is still part of DHS.
Madam Chair, I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Government Relations Director for DCYF, and we're tagging along with DHS today.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Dan Storkamp, Operations Director for Direct Care and Treatment, and I will kick off the presentation here today. And first of all, Marshall Smith, our executive director, asked us to be here and sends his regret that he couldn't be here. As you heard from Ms. Johnson here, that, or Ms. Freeman, that DC&T is going to be our own separate agency starting July 1. So we're very excited about partnering and being a part of this group and coming back over the next several years and building this relationship as we move forward. I know many of you have visited Anoka before, as well as Senator Rasmussen was visiting Moose Lake and St. Peter this year. Mm-hmm. We offer tours to any of you that you'd like to visit anytime to see what we do and what is out there in our facilities. As you know, DCT provides direct care treatment, secure treatment for CD, mentally ill, developmentally disabled, as well as the sex offenders. And we got over 150 locations in Minnesota. And please remember that our facilities are homes for our staff, and it just adds an extra layer as we start talking about all the infrastructure and all the different plumbing and electrical issues that are going on in that process. So I'm going to ask Nancy Freeman to walk through our presentation on our asset preservations that the governor is recommending.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you go one back?
Sure.
Thank you. So it might seem like just bricks and mortar, water pipes and windows, restrooms and classrooms, roofs and foundations. But these requests are really investments in people, the most important kind of infrastructure. They're investments in our state-operated behavioral health care system, where patients with mental illness and substance use disorders find stability and recovery, and eventually a return to the community. Clients with disabilities find welcoming residential and vocational services. Patients with disabilities receive special care dental services. There are investments in safety and security for patients and staff in state-operated mental health facilities. These are the real assets we're talking about, we're hoping to preserve, and the infrastructure we're hoping to improve. Our first request is for asset preservation for $11.43 million in GEO bonds that will ensure the state-owned facilities used for DCT are functional, safe, and in good repair. It may have a budget impact for future operating budgets with the replacement of more energy-efficient building components, roof insulation, HVAC equipment, etc. DCT owns and maintains a little over 3 million square feet of physical plant for its operations, which, as you probably know, include facilities in St. Peter, Anoka, Moose Lake, Brainerd, Wilmer, and 70-plus group homes throughout Minnesota. This does not include an additional about 750,000 square feet of leased space that we lease from private or commercial entities across DCT. DCT facilities are highly secured and heavily constructed while also being therapeutic environments. Makes them pretty unique in that concept. The replacement value for these assets is currently a little over $1 billion. The deferred maintenance from last year's facility condition assessments is $185 million. There will never be an absence of deferred maintenance balance for DCT. In our 10-year strategic plan, we estimate $30 million per biennium to address the most critical needs, those identified as poor and unacceptable with the facility condition assessments, and allow work to be completed within the current resources and staff. Project priorities are based on need and level of deficiency, critical projects that require immediate action, projects that will become critical in a short amount of time if not corrected soon, and projects that require reasonably prompt attention. You can go to the next one, please. Oh, one more. Go one more, sorry. So I know this is a little hard to see. So this is our asset preservation project that we actually presented last year. And we always put in, we're required to put in how much energy savings we have. And so of these projects that are listed, we're estimating about $500,000 annually that we could save in energy improvements by doing these projects. The $30 million identified in our 10-year strategic plan is necessary to maintain our capital plan. Every biennium, this is not appropriated, it exacerbates the issue. Ultimately, this compounds the existing deferred maintenance problem, as I'm sure a lot of other agencies have stated. This compounds the existing deferred maintenance problem, resulting in substantial increases year after year in the long-range deferred maintenance and renewal and replacement projects at DHS. Next one. Our second priority is the construction for the St. Peter Water and Sewer down in St. Peter. St. Peter is our oldest site, and I believe a lot of you have been there. It's $15 million to upgrade and replace the water and sanitary storm sewer infrastructure on the St. Peter campus. This will ensure that state-owned facilities used for DCT services are functional, safe, and in good repair. The present drinking water system and sanitary and storm sewer systems on the lower campus were constructed in the early 1950s and have far exceeded their useful lives. In 2018, we contracted with an engineering firm and conducted a water and sewer system analysis. The analysis found several deficiencies and recommended replacement of the water main, sanitary sewer, and storm sewer infrastructure located throughout the entire campus. Without this improvement, the probability of failure seems high. It is very imperative to replace this critical infrastructure to ensure the campus can continue to operate 24/7, 365, and serve the needs of over 1,100 people consisting of patients, clients, and staff. In 2023, you appropriated $1.05 million for the design of this system. The design is complete and it's ready to go out to bid should it be appropriated at this time.
Madam Chair, those are the direct care and treatment initiatives. We could stand for questions before we go to the next section, if you'd like.
Ms. Freeman, I didn't quite hear your last sentence. How much did we put in for design in 23?
$1.05 million.
Okay. All right, so that's been done, and you're shovel-ready now. Do you got the construction documents? And probably could have done it last year.
Madam Chair, yes, we just completed the design, okay. And we're ready to go out to bid.
Great, good timing then.
Thank you.
All right. Any questions from members of the committee? All right. Thank you very much. Well, members, we did really well. I thought we were going to go to 6 o'clock, but I don't know if any of us would have lasted. Oh, wait, we have more? Oh, I apologize. I thought you were done. All right, continue.
I'll go as quickly as I can.
Early childhood facilities. All right. No, we have plenty of time. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Jennifer Sommerfeld from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And I'm going to cover the governor's proposal for early childhood. So the governor's proposal includes $2.7 million in general obligation bonds for the construction and renovation of statewide early childhood facilities. These will be grants for state agencies and political subdivisions to construct new facilities or renovate aging substandard ones. These grants are intended to increase access to childcare and age-appropriate high-quality learning opportunities for more young children and their families. And it aligns with the governor's One Minnesota plan that prioritizes positive outcomes for children and families and increases access to affordable, high-quality childcare. Grants for these programs will be awarded through a competitive RFP, which includes a 25% match of non-state funds. And that is the only change that will be in the legislative language, is reducing it from 50% right now to 25%. In the past, projects have included public school districts that have built early childhood education and Head Start classroom space, with most of the projects occurring in Greater Minnesota. A grant for an individual project must not exceed $500,000. If there are multiple of programs within one facility, all of them receiving grants, the whole project must not exceed $2 million for the facility, or $500,000 for each program. So that's this piece. I'll just note this slide includes pictures, or includes a picture of where we've done projects in the past. Between 1992 and 2014, approximately $23 million in general fund or general obligation bonds were appropriated for early childhood facilities. Of those, 75% were in Greater Minnesota, and 75 projects in Greater Minnesota, and 18 in Minnesota. The metro area. Prior to the 2023 session, that was the last time funds were appropriated, was 2014, when we received $6 million. In 2023, $2.025 million was appropriated for early childhood facilities, and that of that, $900,000 was in general obligation bonds, and $1.125 million was in general fund, a general fund appropriation. In 2024, the $1.125 million general fund appropriation was canceled from the bonding bill, and it was moved to expenditures for facilities improvements for smaller childcare facilities. So there's a program through our childcare services division that runs that. I believe there was an expectation that hopefully the bill would move forward and we would be able to replace those, but that did not happen. So right now we're working with $900,000 in an RFP that will go out in February for projects for this year. So we're hoping to add to that through the additional $2.7 million. And that's all I have. Thank you.
So, Ms. Sommerfeld, I believe there was a program, and I don't remember if it was this one, or I think there's another early childhood facilities program, where we didn't really appropriate enough money for, maybe it was only, maybe we are talking about the $900,000, to make it worthwhile to do an RFP, and the department kind of held back to wait for another funding cycle. Was that the case with this program?
Yes, that was the $900,000, and at the time the $1.125 million. I think the goal was to get a bit more money involved in there so we would have a bigger opportunity to fund programs.
So if we appropriate this at around this level, then you'd combine that with what we did in 23?
I don't think so at this point. We are moving forward with the $900,000 in RFP in February, just because they've been waiting for a while, so there's a lot of need out there.
Okay, got it. Any questions? And did you have anything else? I don't want to skip over you again.
No, I think I'm done. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you for being here. And if there's no comments from any members of the committee, then the committee is adjourned.